She was warned. She was given an explanation. Nevertheless, she persisted.
Hello and welcome to The Persistence. This is She Who Persisted, the Nasty Podcast. My name is Beatrice and I'm here with
Elizabeth.
For the first time.
In person, not via computer.
Not via computer.
I mean, Liz, we're via computer for you, but yeah, not for us.
Liz came out of my computer and now she's in Vienna with me.
Yes, I'm like the girl from The Ring.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and today we will talk about
sex positive feminism.
Yeah. Oh, actually, before we start doing that, I just wanted to say thank you to one of our listeners who wrote us a really, really lovely listener email.
Mm-hmm. I don't have it in front of me, so I can't remember her name.
Her name was Ina.
Ina, yes, yes.
Thank you.
It was amazing. And yeah, we are super excited about a lot of the topics that you mentioned in the email, and hopefully they will be coming up as episodes soon.
Yeah. Okay. So Liz suggested to talk about sex-positive feminism today.
Yeah, so we've kind of mentioned sex-positive feminism in the past, but we were like, well, that's another topic for another day. And
yeah,
this is that day, apparently.
This is that day, and today we also want to get into the basics, I think.
Yes, some of the basics, some of the background about how sex-positive feminism kind of emerged, when it emerged, and in doing that, we have to talk about pornography.
Mm.
So if you're not comfortable talking about pornography, or maybe if you have small children in the car, though I don't know that you would have small children in the car while listening to our podcast anyway. So
we'll also talk about sex work.
And sex work, yes. Just so you know.
Yeah.
Preview.
Exactly, yeah. Listener discretion is advised, as they say.
Yes. So you want me to start?
Yeah.
Okay. So sex positive feminism promotes the idea that sexual freedom is an essential component of women's freedom. So women should be full members of society, feeling like they can have sex and that they can enjoy sex and mm-hmm. that sex is perfectly fine.
Mm-hmm.
Sex positive feminists oppose legal or social efforts to control sexual activities between consenting adults, whether they're initiated by the government or other feminists or opponents of feminism or any other institution. And they embrace sexual minority groups, endorsing the value of coalition building with marginalized groups. And sex positive feminism is also connected with the sex positive movement.
Mm-hmm. Did you read anything about the difference between the sex positive movement and sex positive feminism? Because for me, whenever I read sex positivity, it always seems to be in connection with feminism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wrote that and I read about it a little bit, but I didn't really focus on what the sex positive movement was different from sex positive feminism,
mm-hmm.
because I think sex positive feminism is focused exclusively or primarily, let's just say primarily, on women and minority sexual groups mm-hmm. and promoting sexuality as part of their freedom.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think the sex positive movement more generally isn't so much focused on how sex and sexual freedom mm-hmm. is related to women's freedom, minority group freedom.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Yeah.
So a little bit of background. Mm. And this, some of this is taken from Wikipedia because they give a very lovely, albeit very reductive, explanation of the history of sex positive feminism. And Beatrice is going to come in with some critiques.
Yeah,
I'm
going to poo-poo all over it.
But it's good because it's good to have this conversation about why the Wikipedia entry, like, number one, like, sanitizes, but also, like, silences some of the discourse that was going on. So it's also called pro-sex feminism, sex radical feminism, sexually liberal feminism. It started in the early 1980s, and centers on the idea that sexual freedom is important for women's freedom. And so when I hear sexual freedom, I think women's freedom to have sex or not to have sex. Mm. So women can be sexual beings without being slut-shamed. They can choose to not have sex or even be asexual, and all of that is okay.
Yeah.
But I think we all know that it's not quite that simple. and a lot of the conversations online about sex positive feminism. Yeah. I read this one blog piece that said, you know, stop trying to like make me have sex. And I don't think that I don't think that sex positive feminists are shaming you because you don't have sex. But maybe, I mean, I don't know.
I'm not sure if sex positive feminism does it, but I think, you know, society as a whole, a lot of times does it, you know, because we do have slut shaming on the one hand, but then there's also, can we call it prude shaming? I don't know.
Yeah, sure.
You know, not having sex as a woman in this world is something that is definitely linked to your worth. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
And we talked about this, you guys talked about this when you did the asexuality episode that like, you know, asexuality, it, like, it's perfectly fine. People don't understand it. People don't get it. But it's an important part of this kind of spectrum of like people's desires.
And not just asexuality. I mean, you can be not asexual and still don't have sex because you don't want to, because there's no one you want to have sex with at the moment, or because you just want to figure something out for yourself.
Or
I don't know,
because like you have you know, personal issues,
whatever,
trauma surrounding sex. Like you can still be sex positive for other people and just not want to do it yourself.
I think, I mean, the trauma thing is very important because we talked about this very shortly before the recording. You know, the whole question of, and I will come in, I will go into that when I talk about power structures and how I sometimes feel that, you know, sex positive feminism ignores that. You know, there's one thing about trauma and not having sex because of that, that is sometimes, I think, not dealt with very well by sex positive feminism. But then on the other hand, I think it's also kind of problematic to talk about this, or to only talk about, you know, people not having sex because they have traumas or issues or whatever, because sometimes people just choose not to have sex for whatever reason. So I think, and that might also kind of solidify a stereotype of people who choose not to have sex, that is just because they are troubled in whatever way,
absolutely.
Which is, doesn't necessarily have to be the case. You can choose not to have sex just because you don't want to have sex and that's it.
Yes. And it doesn't mean that you're sex negative.
No.
Or that you're not feminist or
whatever. Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, so Wikipedia suggests that in the 80s, some women promoted sex-positive feminism in response to efforts by anti-pornography feminists to put pornography at the center of a feminist explanation of women's oppression. So there definitely was a group of women who were anti-pornography, and they were focused on how it was part of patriarchal oppression. That's not up for debate. Sex-positive feminists often saw this and saw, you know, that this thought that this was kind of sex-negative, that, you know, and then maybe part of sex-positive feminism evolved from this, but I think that it's more complicated than that.
Yeah. And also, one issue that I have with this sentence is that they put pornography at the center of their analysis of patriarchal oppression, because I don't think they actually did. They definitely saw pornography as a problem and as an expression of patriarchy, but I don't think that they put it at the center of their idea of patriarchal oppression. But they basically claimed that pornography is essentially a form of sexual or other violence against women. But one thing that I think is necessary to stress, that most of the time they're only talking about a specific type of pornography. I don't know if we want to call it mainstream porn, but let's just go with it for the moment. That basically caters to a male gaze and completely objectifies women, has no interest in female sexual pleasure or in sexual pleasure of people other than men.
I mean, or straight men. Show women supposedly experiencing pleasure, but the important part of mainstream porn is like men getting off,
male ejaculation, basically. And so I think it's much more complicated and difficult. The debate is much more difficult than Wikipedia makes it out to be, because it's not that there were this group of like sex negative feminists who were like, porn is wrong, period. But it was like, there is a specific type of porn out there that is, you know, mainstream porn or whatever.
But to be fair, in like the 70s, late 70s, early 80s, mainstream porn was mostly all there was. It wasn't until, and we'll get into this in a little bit later, in the 80s that we actually, late mid 80s, we actually start getting some feminist pornography. And we had like little pieces of feminist pornography before that. But like mostly all there was in the porn industry in Los Angeles, in the Valley, was this kind of male-centered, male-focused mainstream porn.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, one person that I think you're going to talk about, McKinnon and Dworkin for a bit.
Andrea Dworkin and Catherine McKinnon were the... And I actually saw a great lecture by Catherine McKinnon a few years ago, but that's neither here nor there.
What was it about?
I want to say that it was about women in developing countries.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah, she's a lawyer, so it was about legal issues.
Yeah.
But anyway... So there were others in this kind of group of anti-pornography feminists. Well, I'll call them anti-pornography feminists instead of anti-sex feminists.
Yeah, which makes a huge difference.
Yeah. They argued that porn and the porn industry exploit women are complicit in violence against women. Mm-hmm. I think that that's probably fair. And that they're complicit in the violence both in the production, where they charge that the abuse and exploitation of women performing in pornography is rampant, which...
It's still the case.
Mm-hmm. And in the consumption, in that pornography eroticizes the domination, humiliation, and coercion of women and reinforces sexual and cultural attitudes that are complicit in rape and sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. Again.
Not wrong,
right? I mean, this is pretty, yeah. They argued, and I would say, I mean, if Andrea Dworkin were still with us, would probably continue to argue that pornography contributes to a male-centered objectification of women and thus to sexism. And, I mean, if we think about what our definition of sexism is, yeah, I mean, objectification of women, discriminating against women because of their sex, you know, focusing only on women's external and sexual value to society, all of those kinds of things. It's tough to argue against any of this. but what ends up happening is that the women who participate in pornography and in other sex work are then demonized. Mm. And the conversation ends up being about women who are complicit in their own sexual exploitation and women who are attacking these women because they are anti-pornography and therefore they must be anti-sex. Mm-hmm. And in case you can't tell, this is sarcastic.
Yeah. I think we will also get into that in more detail later on, but I would argue that those two perspectives, like the quote unquote sex negative and the quote unquote sex positive perspective, are not actually as contradictory as they are made out to be, because I kind of agree with both of those feminist perspectives.
Sure.
Because I think that you can, on the one hand, analyze certain power structures also within sexuality or sexual encounters or sexual media. And criticize them for, you know, how they perpetuate certain patriarchal ideas or gender norms or power structures. And on the other hand, you can also think that people should have the right to find pleasure in their sexuality. So I think both of those things go together. I don't necessarily think that those two perspectives are contradictory.
You are absolutely right.
Yeah, wow.
So Wikipedia, again, suggests that this period, quote, this period of intense debate and acrimony between sex positive and anti-pornography feminists during the 80s is often referred to as the feminist sex wars.
Which it actually is. And it's horrible. It's so stupid.
Yes.
It's so annoying. Okay. So no war ever happened. Women disagreed. That's all.
But clearly when women disagree, it leads to like...
A bitch fight. It's always a bitch fight.
It's a bitch fight. It's a division within the ranks of, you know, the women, whatever. Feminists. Yeah. Feminists can't ever agree on anything. Or at least that's what mainstream media type folks would have you believe.
And that has a lot to do with stereotypes about women.
Yes.
Because there is this idea there that women... the women cannot ever agree on anything, you know, like, and that anything that we disagree on is always like an emotional battle, you know, a war.
Yes.
More than just a disagreement.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I don't understand how, you know, men can have like a disagreement and it's just a debate.
A civil debate. Yeah.
It's a civil debate. But with women, it's the feminist sex war.
It's not a feminist sex war. It's just that women disagreed on the subjects of pornography and sex work in the context of feminism. And that's a very important discussion. It's a still ongoing discussion, I would say. It's not a war. And also both sides, or actually there were never really two sides, but it's a very, you know, there were multiple sides because it's a very varied and complex discussion. So rather the people involved all basically have the same goal, which is the end of patriarchy and gender-based oppression.
Yes.
So no, there's no war going on.
No, I mean, we just maybe disagree on aspects of how to achieve the end goal, which is this end of patriarchy and gender-based oppression. We have different methods. Maybe we can approach all of them.
Yeah.
In different ways.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be a war.
No, nobody died.
No.
Nobody died.
Yeah. So what ends up happening is, like, other feminists identifying as sex positive got involved in the debate, not in opposition to other feminists, but in direct response to what they saw as the patriarchal control of sexuality. So, like, they aren't necessarily debating the anti-pornography feminists or any other feminists, but they're saying, like, you patriarchy, you're the problem. I'm not going to be involved in this debate.
Mm-hmm.
Some, and I'm going to say radical feminists, this is also a term that is really debated, but it's a term that kind of comes from second wave feminism. Mm. But they also reject the dichotomy of sex positive, sex negative feminism, instead suggesting that the real divide is between liberal feminism and radical feminism. Mm. And so here there is a good quote from Gail Rubin that kind of summarizes the conflict over sex within feminism. And Gail Rubin, I want to say that she was more on the sex positive side, but again, the sex positive, pro-sex, whatever. Anyway, here we go. There have been two strains of feminist thought on the subject. One tendency has criticized the restrictions on women's sexual behavior and denounced the high costs imposed on women for being sexually active. This tradition of feminist sexual thought has called for a sexual liberation that would work for women as well as for men. The second tendency has considered sexual liberalization to be inherently a mere extension of male privilege. This tradition resonates with conservative anti-sexual discourse. So, what does it mean for sexual liberation to work for both men and women, but not be part of male privilege?
Mm.
Like, I think that's the question that you have to ask with sex positive feminism, because that's really what Gail Rubin is saying, right?
Yeah.
She's saying that the tradition of kind of liberal feminism, sex positive liberal feminism, is that we should be liberated with our sexuality and it will work for men and women. And because it's directly in some ways, or it's not part of this other strain of feminism, it isn't an extension of male privilege.
Yeah.
What does that look like? Yeah. And I don't know if we know what that looks like.
No. Because I think a lot of times the way we think of sexual liberation is exactly what she describes as an extension of male privilege.
Yeah.
One thing that just I thought about was the invention of the pill.
Yes.
Which originally was something that really liberated women, because it kind of took away this fear of getting pregnant all the time.
Yes.
So women could enjoy heterosexual encounters.
Yes.
Let's put it that way. Heterosexual penis and vagina sex.
Yes.
Let's not just call it sexual encounters, because that's much more than that.
Penetrative, heterosexual.
Exactly.
Cisgendered sex. Well, maybe not even cisgendered.
Well, let's just.
Yeah.
You know what we mean.
We know.
Yeah. in that context, women gained a bit of sexual freedom, but then on the other hand, it again put the burden of contraception onto women.
Absolutely. So,
and that's not a liberation.
No, I saw this meme online the other day, and I'm totally going to get it not right because it was very pithy and I can never remember the pithiness, but it was like, so you have a problem like just putting on a condom, like, and you're fertile, you man are fertile all the time, and you're putting the onus on me, who is only fertile like 7 days of the week or 7 days of the month, if that, to take a pill every single day that has like possibly negative health effects for me. Like, really? Really? That's you're like, I am only actually fertile like a very small amount of the month.
Yeah.
And you produce this blah all the time. So
yeah. So I think it's kind of this two-shielded sword. Can you say that in English?
Two-sided.
Two-sided. It's two-sided.
Double-edged?
Double-edged.
That's the word in English.
That's the word I was looking for. Because on the one hand, it did liberate women, but it only liberated women within a very patriarchal framework.
Yeah.
Because it made it easier for them to function within that patriarchal framework.
Yes.
It didn't actually liberate us.
No, it doesn't actually change the framework at all.
No.
All it does is give women an opportunity to not get pregnant, which then gives them more opportunities, but it's all still within the same framework.
Exactly. Yeah. And also there was this, I mean, some, I think it was Bayer or some of the pharmacological companies that did research on the male pill, and there were a few side effects, but those were minor in comparison to the side effects that the pill has, especially that it had when it came out originally.
Yes.
But it was still considered too much for men to take, you know, so yeah.
Cry me a river.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, we talked about this several times on the podcast already that apparently it's men and male bodies and men's feelings or well-being that's valued much more than women's.
Which I think is crazy because we don't like to talk about men's feelings, and yet we're much more concerned about men's feelings. Like, and maybe it's that we're concerned that men would have to express their emotions, that they actually have to express the pain, that they actually have to experience pain and be emotive about that. And so we don't want that to happen. And so we aren't willing to impose that upon them.
Yeah.
But because women are already, quote unquote, emotional.
We're already a mess. So it doesn't really matter.
It's fine. Yeah. Fine. Just fine.
Yeah. But, you know, in summary, it kind of really placed the whole burden of contraception on women. And it's still the case. I mean, when I talk to friends of mine, I'm the only one basically who doesn't take the pill. I've never taken the pill. I don't want to take it. I don't want to take medicine every day and kind of, you know, go through that. I also don't want to deal with the side effects. So, and I also think it's not fair in like a heterosexual situation to be the only one who's responsible for what's going on.
Absolutely. I have taken the pill. I've taken it to like regulate my hormones. I've taken it for a lot of different reasons over the years, but I don't like taking it. Mm. It makes me feel, first of all, it makes me gain weight, which makes me uncomfortable in my own skin.
Mm.
Not from any social thing, but like physically I feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, yeah.
But then also it just makes me feel uneven, if that's like
that
emotionally
times,
uneven. And so I'd rather not take it.
Mm.
I am lucky that I am in a committed long-term monogamous relationship, and I can talk, you know, we've been very comfortable using condoms, and my husband has no problem with that, and we don't want to have children. So we're like totally on board with using condoms and not having kids.
Yeah.
So, and it doesn't, the responsibility isn't on me.
Yeah, like, so it's a shared responsibility.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I may occasionally purchase the condoms at the grocery store or drugstore or whatever, but yeah, it's a totally shared responsibility.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is lovely.
And it's how it should be, I think, yeah. So
anyway, so that kind of explanation is how sex-positive feminism started out. With the anti-pornography, and maybe like partially as a response to anti-pornography discourses. But in the last 30 plus years, a lot has changed. So what is sex feminism today?
Sex-positive feminism.
So sex-positive feminism has brought together anti-censorship activists, LGBTQ activists, feminist scholars, sex radicals, producers of pornography and erotica, among others, though not all members of these groups are necessarily both feminists and sex-positive individuals.
Mm.
Sex-positive feminists reject the vilification of male sexuality that many attribute to radical feminism and instead embrace the entire range of human sexuality.
Which is also very, very, you know, a very limited perspective again, I think.
Absolutely.
It's just very reduced to.
Yes. No, I totally agree with you. I mean, one of the ways I think that it becomes more inclusive is to say, like, sex isn't just about, like, male sexuality. Mm. It's about, like, a broader array of sexuality. Yeah. Sex-positive feminists argue that the patriarchy limits sexual expression are in favor of giving people of all genders more sexual opportunities rather than restricting pornography. So more porn more opportunities for people to express their sexuality. I mean, in a way, and we'll talk about this in a bit, you know, some of the pornography that emerged as a result of the anti-pornography, you know, discourse mm-hmm. was feminist pornography. Mm-hmm. So sex positive feminism led to feminist pornography that considers women's sexual pleasure, which mm-hmm. is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Sex-positive feminists generally reject sexual essentialism, mm-hmm. Which is defined by Gail Rubin as, quote, the idea that sex is a natural force that exists prior to social life and shapes institutions. So that we don't have these drives to have sex necessarily, that we're not driven by sex, that it's pre-social, but instead that it's also constructed. It's a social, you know, sex and the way that we have sex and the types of sex that we have is socially constructed mm-hmm. as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they see sexual orientation and gender as social constructs that are heavily influenced by society.
Mm-hmm.
So sex radical feminists in particular come to a sex positive stance from a deep distrust in the patriarchy's ability to secure women's best interest in sexually limiting laws. So when society says, oh, we're doing this to protect the ladies, God, yeah. that's where sex positive feminists say, really? Okay. Mm. So other feminists identify sexual liberation as the real motive behind the women's movement. Naomi Wolf writes that the orgasm is the body's natural call to feminist politics. I'm sorry, Naomi I can't Wolf. Say that with a straight face.
Naomi Wolf. Okay. So, I'm going to try to come up with like a very serious criticism of this. And that's that I think a lot of time this idea is very in line. And that's something that I'm very skeptical of or mm-hmm. something that it's suspiciously close to neoliberal identity politics. And
I think that could be a legitimate criticism of sex positive yes. feminism. And yes. I think that is a legitimate criticism that we see a lot about yeah. sex positive feminism, yeah. that it's like, really, this seems very like neoliberal, like me, like, yeah. Or yeah.
And especially the thing, and I'm saying this here because she said like orgasm is the body's natural call to feminist politics. And honestly, I mean, having an orgasm is great.
Yes.
It will make you feel better. It will give you maybe more energy to tackle issues that patriarchy hands out to you on a daily basis, but it will not make women get paid more. It will not secure reproductive rights. The huge problem that I have with sex positive feminism is that it tends to forget about structural inequalities and pretends that everything's just fine. And all we have to do is treat ourselves with sexual pleasure and do that, but no, that's not all. If that's all that there is to your feminism, then I think that's not feminism.
Oh no, I totally agree with
that's
you.
That's neoliberalism.
Yeah, I mean, well, what's really interesting is one of the things that, especially with Andrea Dworkin and the anti-pornography mm-hmm. discourse around feminism, about sexuality and feminism mm-hmm. or whatever, one of the like slurs that was always then thrown at feminists was that they needed to get laid. Ugh. That they just needed to get laid. Why yeah. did they take everything so seriously? They just needed to get laid. They didn't appreciate pornography because they were sexless.
Yeah.
Because whatever. And that's just like the orgasm being the body's natural call to feminist politics is like mm. the feminist like way of saying you just need to get laid.
Yeah. Just, you know, I mean, imagine the day when I finally get laid and then I wake up the next day and patriarchy is gone and I don't need to be a feminist anymore.
I know.
If it would be that simple, that would be amazing.
Right? If every woman in the world had an orgasm and then tomorrow patriarchal structures, which keep us from getting paid equally and you know, whatever else just disappeared. Amazing.
Amazing.
I don't think that's how it works.
No, getting laid does not do away with patriarchy. We've all tried it.
Yes. But Shannon Presley, the national coordinator for the Association of Libertarian Feminists,
mm-hmm.
writes that in the area of sexuality, the government blatantly discriminates against women. And this is totally true. I mean, she's coming from a libertarian perspective, which says that like the government shouldn't be making laws that limit our freedoms. Which in a lot of ways, is a very feminist perspective. It can also be not so feminist, but yeah, I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it, when the government passes, can pass laws that discriminate against women, it can also pass laws that make life a lot easier for women and women's sexuality, you know, like allowing birth control in the United States to be paid for by insurance and not making women Austria. Have to pay for it. Or in Austria.
To pay for it.
That's a problem too.
That was the other thing that I wanted to say when we talked about the pill, is that it's not just women's responsibility then to use contraception, but also their financial responsibility.
But look, I mean, in Austria, in most European countries, the birth rate is declining, so they don't actually want to pay for the pill for women. They want women to have babies because they need to increase the birth rate. They need the people so that they can...
They need the people, and then also all those bad refugees are coming in.
Oh my God.
And we'll have so many, we'll just, like, in no time, we'll just have, like, Syrian babies. What are we going to do?
I can't.
Sorry, this is sarcasm.
This is very sarcasm. This is sarcasm. Please don't think that we're anti-Syrian refugee. Please don't think that we...
Don't write us angry emails.
...are trying to get the explain away. Like, no, please, please.
Just don't.
Yeah. So some of the social background in which some like sex-positive feminists operate has to also be understood. In Christian societies are often influenced by what's understood as quote-unquote traditional sexual morality. And according to Christian doctrine, sexual activity can only take place in marriage, and it can only be vaginal intercourse, and sexual acts outside marriage, and unnatural sex, i.e. oral, anal, also termed sodomy, are forbidden. Yet forced sexual intercourse within marriage is not seen as immoral by many social and religious conservatives, which there's like this whole existence of so-called conjugal rights defined in the Bible, blah, blah, blah.
And let's just replace the term forced sexual intercourse with
Let's call it what it is. Rape within marriage.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, like, when you come from a background that says that women should have sex with their husbands no matter what, and rape within marriage is totally fine, and that sex has to take place within marriage, that women can't have sex outside of marriage, that oral and anal sex are forbidden, like, you are limiting women's sexuality significantly.
Everyone's sexuality.
Everyone's sexuality, yeah. But particularly...
Women's sexuality.
Mere
penetrative sex is rarely very pleasurable. I mean, it
can be.
It can be pleasurable, but it's usually not the best thing that can happen to your body in a sexual encounter.
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, thinking about what are alternative ways that one can have sex other than penetrative sex that are pleasurable for maybe both people. And that then gets back to Gail Rubin's idea of like it being sexually liberating for men and women. Yeah.
And also I love how Christian people or Christian or the church calls it traditional sexual morality, while it's something that they came up with.
I know.
It's not traditional at all. It's just an invention that you made and then you called it traditional.
I know. I mean, and when we think about other societies, you know, Christians focusing on traditional sexual morality would say, well, you know, we don't want to get into moral relativism, blah, blah, blah. But like, there are legitimately other cultures that have other perspectives on sex. I mean, it has never been, anthropologists will say there has never actually been a matriarchal society, as much as we think that there have been societies that have given women more rights or have been more like maternally focused. They have never actually
no proof of it.
An actual matriarchy. But let's imagine what that might be like. Let's imagine what it might be like to have sex within a society where like women are valued.
Where our bodies are valued and where we can enjoy our bodies, you know. And I think the key point of Christian morality is that it's not about sex at all. It's just about reproduction.
Yes.
So I think that's the key that we...
It's not about pleasure.
It's not about pleasure at all. in fact, pleasure is really vilified, you know. The bad thing about sex is pleasure. The good thing is reproduction, which is the exact opposite of what we want nowadays.
Sure. So when I got married, I got married in the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. We had to do these classes before we got married. And we had to sit down and talk to a priest and, you know, a couple times. We'd take a test, see if we were compatible. Okay. And we had to go to this, like, engagement thing with, like, other engaged people, whatever. Anyway, we were talking to the priest about having children, I think it was. And I think it was the priest, okay. And I think it wasn't in one of these other groups, but yeah. Bear with me. Basically, like, Jesus is there in the room with you when a man and woman have sex.
That's creepy.
I left that meeting with my fiancé at the time, now husband's, and said... And I was kind of joking, but it was like, this is an odd conversation to have. And I said, so basically when married people have sex, it's a threesome with Jesus. Mm. And my husband's like, you're going to hell. And I was like, I'm okay with that. I'm still going to make the jokes. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, like, that's the idea that, like, it's matrimony, like marriage and a man and a woman, like a married couple having sex, having gone through the sacrament of marriage, like... them having sex is sacred in some way, and that is potentially producing like another human being, mm-hmm. which great, you know, think of it as sacred. It can also be pleasurable.
Yeah.
Like it's perfectly maybe it should okay. Also be. So yes. So in addition to this idea of like conjugal rape being totally fine, certain cultures, particularly countries influenced by Roman Catholicism, in these cultures, traditional ideas of they have traditional ideas of masculinity and female purity. Mm-hmm. And this is what led to what many interpret as a double standard between male and female sexuality. And so this is where we have men who are expected to be sexually assertive as a way of affirming their masculinity. But for women to be considered, quote unquote, good, she has to remain pure. So you have these men who are supposed to be pursuing women, but women who are supposed to like not be having sex and like rebuffing their advances, which goes to this medieval idea of minna, which is like a woman who's like pure and chaste and who's like constantly pursuing her. Mm-hmm. And she's like,
basically like a romantic comedy.
Essentially. Yes. And so Cesar Lombroso claimed in his book, The Female Offender, that because of this, like women can be categorized into three types, the criminal woman, the prostitute, or the normal woman. And as such, like highly sexed women, prostitutes, were deemed as like abnormal. Mm.
Did he also come up with like a checklist where you can test yourself whether you're a criminal woman or a prostitute or a normal woman? Because I'd be interested in taking that test.
I can create that little survey.
That would be amazing.
We can do one of those little like BuzzFeed surveys.
And
like,
see whether we're criminal or normal or prostitute.
Yes.
Or all of the above.
Yes. So, yes, one of the critiques that we have of sex positive feminism on the part of Christians is that it's leading women to have sex and be these like dirty sex having sex enjoying women.
Imagine.
Who are having sex before marriage. Bad, bad, bad. On the other hand, we have other feminists who are saying like sex positive feminism is not actually addressing patriarchy, which is what we've talked about. Mm. I mean, it's great, like have sex if you want to have sex, like don't feel shamed for having sex, but like maybe there's more to feminism than just being
just enjoying life
open.
Yeah. So one thing that you already mentioned was the whole issue of feminist pornography. Mm-hmm. Now I just took some notes while you were talking because I came up with that and I just now don't know how to say it, but the thing is, porn is a cultural artifact, just like any other type of film or any other type of, I don't know, music, novels, whatever. It's a cultural, pop cultural artifact. And as a cultural artifact that originates from a patriarchal society, it will bear the mark of patriarchy.
Yes.
So we should not be surprised that there is a lot of porn out there that is very patriarchal.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, I think the question is there really a difference between porn that is patriarchal and other types of media that are just as patriarchal? And why is that such a like dividing point? Because we could also sit there and talk about Disney films, you know?
Oh, absolutely. There are a lot of terrible patriarchal Disney films.
And just as with porn, it's a very complex issue, you know? So again, like if you have a patriarchal society, there's no surprise. It's no surprise that the media that come out of that society will be patriarchal.
Well, sure. I mean, and if we go to like a Foucauldian reading of it, like there's no outside the system. Like we live in a system that is controlled by our social norms and values and social power. And so if it's a patriarchal system, like we are necessarily, even feminist pornography is necessarily going to be defined in and against and within that patriarchal structure.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That was just like a side note that with which I wanted to question the whole thing of pornography being considered something completely other than all other types of media.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the criticism that goes against pornography also goes, could as well just be used against other types of media.
Sure. I mean, look at advertisements.
Yeah.
I mean, there are so many clothing advertisements that show women like in hardly any clothing, like almost dead or beaten to death and men totally clothed there with no problem. Mm-hmm. And you're like, well, how is this selling clothing?
And so I think one point that sex positive feminists make that is very valid in that context is as soon as sex is part of the equation, we all get so like nervous about it, much more than when it's about other types of media that are not as explicitly sexual.
Yes.
As soon as sex is part of it, we all like, oh my God, it's the devil.
Or people say like, oh, just chill out. It's not such a big deal. Like,
yeah, of course it goes both ways again. Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you already talked about Catherine MacKinnon and Andrea Dworkin, which are usually quoted as the two most important
In America,
exactly. Anti-pornography feminists. But then in the German-speaking context, I think one important name that we have to name is Alice Schwarzer with her magazine Emma and the campaign Porno. I think that's most important in the German-speaking context. And that's always one thing that I never understood about. That there was always one aspect of the debate that I never quite understood, or that always made me question how divided the whole thing actually is, because I think that a lot of disagreement about porn within feminist circles stems from a different understanding of what porn means.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's a definition thing a lot of times, I think, because Schwarzer, for example, does not regard feminist porn as porn.
Mm-hmm.
So for her, porn is always an expression of male violence against women. And in interviews, when she's asked what she thinks about feminist porn, her response usually is, yeah, that's all fine, but that's not porn. That's feminist erotica. That's not porn. So she really differentiates here. So for her, when someone says porn, it's already part of the definition that it's violence against women.
Okay. And I accept that from, I mean, I understand what she's saying.
Yeah.
But I guess my question would be, I mean, from, I write about erotica to some extent in my research. It's, I mean, is it really just, men write erotica, like, and it's not necessarily feminist either. So, like,
I don't think she claims that. I just think that she says, as soon as it's feminist, it cannot be porn because porn means that
porn is a production of the patriarchy. Like,
yeah.
Okay. All
right. In and of itself, and I think that's part of the misunderstanding here.
Okay.
That because I've seen a lot of debates with her, and then there's like a feminist pornographer in the like, and they discuss the whole thing, and then the feminist pornographer is like, yeah, but I made this film, and it's like blah 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 blah, and she's like, yeah, but that's cool, but that's not pornography, you know?
Yeah.
So
she's changing the definitions, or creating a new definition and saying like feminist pornography can by definition not be pornography because pornography is a something created.
It's a patriarchal media.
Yeah, yeah.
You might make, you know, nice, sexy sex films, but it's not pornography then.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the problem then is getting the rest of society on board with a new definition of what pornography is.
And one of the things that I then wondered about is to which extent that's also true for Catherine MacKinnon and Andrea Dworkin, because they also, as far as I know, say that pornography always has like the seed of violence against women.
Yeah.
So I would be interested whether they define, or whether they, when they're confronted with feminist pornography, what they would say, if they would classify that as pornography, or if they would like side with Alice Schwarzer and say that's not actually pornography.
Yeah, sure. I think that would be interesting. I don't know that off the top of my head, but I think that would be interesting.
Mm.
Yeah. Since we're talking about feminist pornography / erotica / feminist sex films, maybe? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
there was an emergence as part of this kind of sex positive feminism that happened in the early, mid 80s. So in 84, a late career porn star, Candice Vadala, also known as Candida Royale,
which is such a cool name.
I know. She formed a production company called Femme Productions and envisioned a new type of pornography or sex film that could celebrate women's sexuality and teach men how to be better lovers. I don't care about, like, if it teaches men to care about women's pleasure, yes, like, that's important. Anyway, she called her alternative porn positive sexual role modeling. And it employed ideas developed by members of Club 90, which was a sex workers collective founded in 83 that met regularly to discuss the sex work industry. And she decided that her sets would be clean, respectful, and put women in control of their own images. So really focus on women and their role in production. So her films included performers of color who were dramatically underrepresented in the industry. And it would also include older actresses, which I'm sure were also underrepresented.
Still all.
Yeah. In an interview with German feminist erotic filmmaker Petra Joy in 2008, she explained that she was inspired to change how women were represented in pornographic films, stating, quote, "These movies are sold based on the women, but our sexuality was completely ignored in them." And she didn't have an easy go of it at all. Distributors were not prepared to change their mindset about porn because distributors were focused on male desire. And they still assumed that men were the primary consumers of porn. And they didn't know what to do with porn that explicitly that didn't explicitly serve the male gaze. That was maybe there for women or couples to enjoy together so that they could like experience their sexuality together. So while the quote unquote feminist sex wars continued,
they were very bloody.
Yes. They were like Game of Thrones. Like, just like imagine. Vadala became a pornography innovator. Her first film, Femme, in 1984, she created a women-centered narrative that countered predictable sexist storylines. The average porn feature typically like rushed through the narrative setup with like a terrible script to get to the money shot. A visible male orgasm splattered all over an actress's body and face. Men dominated the action and women and teaching women lessons about their own bodies. By contrast, that's like typical porn. By contrast, Vidala's stories led the viewer through lush, sensual settings, depicting women's pleasure in seduction and foreplay, as well as intercourse. And just as important, she also introduced a new workplace ethic that protected female workers' physical safety. It gave them power and status to make their own creative decisions on the set, and eventually provided an opportunity for them to direct their own films, which really counters this narrative that we have with normal, regular, male-centered porn, that women are totally dominated and violence is committed against them in the industry as a whole. When you have a type of sexual performance, sexual film that values women, shows women in a positive light, focuses on their pleasure and allows them to have control over their own bodies, that is a totally different thing.
Yep.
So by 2006, so many producers and directors had followed her lead that Toronto's Good for Her adult bookstore established the annual Feminist Porn Awards, which set criteria for what constituted feminist pornography. So to qualify for an award, a film had to use erotic narratives to challenge stereotypes. In porn, this includes featuring performance of color, trans, fat or larger, older or disabled performers who are typically stereotyped or relegated to the fetish porn market rather than mainstream porn. To qualify as feminist pornography, the directors had to put the actor's pleasure and agency at the center of the story, ask for actors' consent for any sexual act, permit actors to revoke consent.
It's so important.
And, yes. And provide clean and safe working conditions. So this kind of pornography becomes like a tangible example of sex positive feminism. It treats women of and men of all ages, sizes, abilities, etc. as people. And it places agency and consent at the heart of sexuality, which is not something that we see in kind of mainstream porn.
It's not something we see in mainstream porn. It's not something we see in a lot of heterosexual encounters.
Yes.
In real life. Absolutely. Outside of porn. So I think that's also maybe the feminist essence of like when we talk about sexuality, like what makes sex, no matter if it's porn or just sex, feminist, I think is always like the issue of consent.
The issue of consent.
It's kind of the key thing.
And the issue of agency.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Where would you draw the line between agency and consent?
That's a great question. That women, I mean, it's particularly in this, that women do not have to be passive, that they can choose to be passive in any sexual encounter, but that they are not passive in the relationship, that it is a co-constructed experience.
Yeah.
And the consent is a valid and very important part of that, but also that women feel like they are equals in the conversation.
So two people that I think are also important in the context of feminist pornography is, first of all, Annie Sprinkle, who is also an American. She's a photographer, a sex educator. She also used to work as a sex worker. She's a pornographic actress, a cable television host, which I did not know. I've never seen it. So she's a sex film producer, sex positive feminist, a porn magazine editor. So Annie Sprinkle, check her out. She's really great.
Susie Bright is also really great. Yeah. She's an author. She had a blog for a while, but she's also written a lot of erotica that is really fantastic. Mm.
And then also a very important European woman in the context of feminist pornography is Erika Lust, who's a porn director, producer, and also a feminist blogger. And she also gave a very interesting TED talk on the subject of feminist pornography in Vienna, just saying, like where we are right now, that we can also link to in the show notes. And she wrote the book X, A Woman's Guide to Good Porn and The Erotic Bible to Europe. And what I really like about her stance on pornography is that she basically also says, well, look, it's just one, it's a type of media, you know? And yes, the type of pictures and images and like material that was produced within that media was very patriarchal because we live in a patriarchal society, but it's also a type of discourse and we can reclaim it. So we can do something else with it. And so let's do that. And then there's one that I really like is Tristan Taormino, who not only edited two editions of the feminist porn book, but she's also a director herself and she's a sex educator. So she did a lot of films that are very educational where she kind of explains things. And she also hosts a radio show that's called Sex Out Loud. And the main reason why I mentioned her, because I really, really like that idea, is that she made a film where she basically just put adult film actors in together, like in a house together for 2 days.
It's like The Real World, but with porn actors.
Okay. And gave them like cameras and said, do whatever you want.
Interesting.
So, and I think that kind of is like a very interesting example of how feminist porn deals with consent very different from mainstream porn, because usually the actresses and actors are involved in creating the script.
Yeah, totally. I mean, the image that we often have in the United States, and this is from films and things like that, is some kind of greasy dude with a mustache behind a camera who is like telling the two people what to do and like, oh, you know, do this, do that, whatever. So it's like very much like you're going to do this and there's no input necessarily on the part of the other people.
And it's something that still happens.
Yeah.
So I watched a discussion on Austrian TV a few days ago where that, you know, and there was like a feminist pornographer and then a sex worker who's also a porn actress.
This was on television?
Yeah. And they were debating pornography and what it means for society and all of that. And of course, there was like a very conservative guy also on the other side. But both the feminist pornographer and the porn actors were really, like, really made really interesting points. And they both said that, so the porn actress said that her first experience with porn was very negative. And that what apparently, so the example that the I forgot her name, but the pornographers came up with was that what a lot of times happens is that, you know, young women are told, for example, it's just going to be a blowjob and we're just going to film you. And then what happens is like, it turns out to be facial abuse, which means that it's like a really, like, really intense deep throating. So it's basically oral rape. And nobody ever, or the woman never consented to it, but it just
Yeah, sure.
It's where the scene is kind of led, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's in a lot of ways, it's pushing boundaries with, I mean, with, and we'll have an episode later about BDSM, but BDSM, you can say, like, these are the boundaries, that, like, this is my hard limit, these are the boundaries that I'm not willing to push, and, like, you have a conversation about this. I don't feel like women in that context get to have a conversation.
Yeah. Like, so I think a lot of porn that is produced is not produced very ethically. And the people that are involved in it often are violated.
Yes, absolutely. And it doesn't it's not mean that just women. It's women and men. And that's and why...
All kinds of people. It's not... And it's it. That doesn't mean that all porn that is produced the way. And it doesn't mean that porn necessarily has to be bad or anti-feminist. It just means that the way that it's practiced right now, a lot of shit happens.
Yes. And this relates back to sex positive feminism, because we want to have situations where people are having sex and are having these conversations and are consenting to what they're doing. And, you know, if we can produce pornography or adult films, whatever you want to call them, that that models that, that is feminist in a lot of ways, then we see that as something that can be part of normal society.
Yeah. Yeah, so I had a conversation with a woman called Polita Pappel, who's also a porn producer, an actor and director. And in the context of the festival that we also did the radio for, the Business Ride Festival. So I did an interview with her in that context. And she said that for her, feminist porn means ethical porn. So it really is about how it is produced, whether everyone gets paid fairly, whether everyone gets treated ethically. There needs to be enthusiastic consent at the center. So everyone is into what happens, not just okay with it, but everyone wants the things that are happening to happen.
Yes.
And she says that it's not about producing a specific type of imagery. So she also argues that when you look at porn, you can't say if it's feminist porn, because it's really what it's really about what goes on behind the scenes.
Sure.
And she also says women are a very heterogenic group. So there are also women who enjoy mainstream imagery, like mainstream porn, and that's okay because, you know, people are different, which, yes, of course. And it's I absolutely agree that it's absolutely okay to enjoy that.
Yes.
But then also, like from a feminist analytical perspective, we learned that. Yes. We learned to like that.
Yes, yes.
And that's also something we must not forget, because, yes, to get back to the other to the Disney films, you can enjoy watching a Disney film. That's fine. I don't judge you for it.
Yes.
I sometimes enjoy watching Disney films. I sometimes enjoy watching shitty movies that are very sexist, you know?
Yeah. We've talked about many sexist movies.
Yeah. And we still can enjoy them as feminists, but that doesn't mean that at the same time I cannot, like, I can still wear my feminist hat and be like, yes, but I learned to enjoy that because the culture that I live in taught me that this is something enjoyable. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think both things are possible at the same time.
Yes. I mean, we mentioned the term male gaze earlier. Yeah. I don't know that we necessarily need to get into like a full discussion of what that is, but I think most movies, not just pornography, not just adult films, or mainstream rather, are made primarily with a male gaze, because that is because that is the audience that they think of.
It's the male position, male heterosexual white position is considered the neutral position.
Yes. Which should not be the case, but that is how our society has constructed the neutral position as a cisgendered male heterosexual white.
Yeah, yeah, and so a lot of times, feminist, even Polita Pappel says you cannot judge from just the imagery whether it's feminist or not, because it's what goes on behind the scenes and how people are treated within the context of making the film. But then, often, feminist pornography or pornographers who consider themselves feminists also apart from the way that they produce the films, you know, apart from the fact that they make sure that everything's produced ethically and everyone's paid fairly and all of that, apart from that, they also a lot of times make films that do not only center on male orgasm, that show a variety of bodies, that show a variety of body types, that show a variety of sexual practices. Because in like a lot of mainstream porn, penis and vagina penetration is kind of the end all of everything, which is, it's fine if you enjoy it. It's fine if you enjoy watching it, but it's just not everything that there is to human sexuality.
Yeah.
A lot of times the feminist porn that is produced focuses on female pleasure, on showing sex that is not heteronormative, showing bodies that are not heteronormative, that don't fit into gender binary necessarily. all of that is also part of feminist pornography.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we've already talked a lot about the critiques of kind of sex positive feminism, how pornography fits into sex positive mm-hmm. feminism. Let's just say the feminist critiques of sex positive feminism are often that it plays into the patriarchy, that it's just mm-hmm. like one of them, the critiques at yeah. least, is that if the patriarchy has convinced you to have lots of sex all the time, like that's because men are trying to convince you to have sex all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, that's one critique that I've seen online and in articles about sex-positive feminism.
Yeah.
Like, which, it's hard to argue necessarily with that. But at the same time, like, I don't want to slut-shame someone for wanting to have sex.
I think it's more complex than that because I think a feminist analysis always asks the question, you know, where's the power in the whole mm-hmm. dynamic? Where, how is even our sexuality, even if we enjoy it, which is all right, how is that kind of connected to patriarchy, mm-hmm. the way we are socialized within our bodies, yes. all of that? So I think it's not that anti-pornography or quote-unquote anti-sex feminists mm-hmm. are actually anti-sex. I think what they do is they say sex is not innocent. Sex is not, it's not like, in, it doesn't mm-hmm. come out of a vacuum. And,
sure.
you know, kind of my critique also lies with the term sex positive feminism, because to me it kind of implies that feminism before that was not sex positive or sex negative.
Oh, I totally agree.
Which I would disagree with. I don't think it is. I don't think feminism has ever been sex negative.
I think there are some people who are sex negative. Well, I mean,
of course, yes. There are always some people who are.
Because there have been conversations within feminism that, like, penetrative sex, any kind of penetrative sex is a violation of
rape,
women.
Yeah.
Is rape.
So, yeah, I mean, but I think for the most part, let's put it that way. I think for the most part, feminism has always wanted to empower women.
Yes.
It's always wanted to empower women sexually. There are just disagreements as to what that empowerment entails.
Exactly.
And radical feminists point out that sexuality does not exist in a vacuum, that it is free of patriarchal oppression, that it's not, you know, that what we want and what we desire and the way that our identities are structured, even our sexual identities themselves and our gendered identities, all of that is a result of the society that we live in.
Yes.
Not just something that just fell down from heaven and we can enjoy it freely, you know? Yeah. And we can enjoy it, but it's not something that's innocent of power.
Yeah. Everything has power embedded. Everything is a reflection of the power structures that we live in.
Yeah. So it's just as embedded in patriarchal hierarchies and power structures and gendered structures as any other part of our life, maybe even more so. I don't know. So, I think that's a critique that I have against some aspects of sex-positive feminism.
Sure.
And one of the things that we haven't talked about that is also a huge part of the feminist sex wars was, apart from pornography, sex work.
Absolutely.
So, and I'm absolutely, let's put it that way, I'm absolutely for the empowerment of sex workers. And I'm like,
sex work has always existed.
Yeah.
And to pretend otherwise and to say that it is somehow like unnatural or that these women are, or men, or, you know, genderqueer, whatever, like that any of them are like terrible because of what they do is absurd, because it's just a fact of life. It's something that
it's
exists.
Part of human sexuality. It's absolutely
work.
Fine. But as a feminist, I also ask the question why it is that in all patriarchal societies, it is kind of a taken for granted part of that society that men bisexual acts from women, but not really vice versa, and definitely not to the same extent, because I know there is sex work for women, and I know that there's both straight and queer sex work for women, but that's really the tiniest percentage.
Oh, agreed.
And
but this goes back to what we were talking
about.
This goes back to what we were talking before about the, like, really the conservative Christian thing that, like, men cannot control their sexuality. They're expected to be like sexual aggressors, and they're expected to, like, be these voracious, like, oh, I want to have sex all the time, blah, blah, blah. To some extent, you know, biologically speaking, testosterone does, you know, sometimes make men more, not virile, but like interested in sex.
Ovulation also does.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Believe me.
But at the same time, like, maybe our feminist conversation needs to be about redefining how we talk about men and their sexuality too. That like, you don't have to be like, that's not the way to be a man. I have a friend who lost his virginity to a sex worker because he didn't want to be a virgin anymore. Yeah. He didn't want to be stigmatized because he was as a man who doesn't have sex.
Yeah. So again, also when it comes to sex work, yes, it's a part of human sexuality, but that we have to ask the power question always, I think, as feminists. And we have to ask why it's mostly men who buy sex from women. And then also, from an intersectional or more intersectional perspective, you have to ask a question why it's mostly disadvantaged women.
Yes.
Such as migrants who do sex work.
You're right. We need to look at the structural inequalities, yes, not just in terms of gender, but the intersectional notion of race, class and gender, mm-hmm, and other intersectional identities and how that contributes to that.
Yeah. So I think we need to talk about why we live in a world where it's considered natural that women are sexually available to men. Mm-hmm. And if they're not sexually available to men in any other way, that they're sexually available for money. Why it's mostly women of color for white men. Mm-hmm. And why it's not really the other way around. So again, I'm all pro sex worker rights. But of course, as everywhere else, there are structural inequalities and structural, mm-hmm, oppression here. And we can pretend that everything's fine, mm-hmm, and there are no problems. And we live in like a unicorn rainbow land and everything's just about individual sexual expression. Mm-hmm. But that is not only very far from the truth, but it's also not very feminist from my point of view, because feminism, as I understand it, always takes into account structural inequalities and it always analyzes those structural inequalities, mm-hmm, and criticizes them.
Yeah.
And it's a fact of life that people do not come to this planet with the same premises and presuppositions and privileges. Some people, like men, like white people, like rich people, are more privileged than others, like women, like people of color, like poor people, like disabled people, whatever, you know? And pretending that everything's fine and every sex worker is only a sex worker because it's her dream job and she loves what she's doing. And I'm, again, not saying that there are no, I'm not saying that there are no sex workers who love what they're doing and more power to them, but pretending that everyone's like that doesn't help anyone and it sure as hell doesn't help women.
Yeah. I mean, just saying like, oh, everybody should just have sex is a somewhat naive approach to feminism.
Yeah, exactly. Naive is a very good word. Yeah. I think that's kind of my main criticism of sex positive feminism sometimes. Yeah. And again, the same thing goes for pornography. We are living in a world that is made for men, not made by them because women do most of the work, even if it's unpaid, but made for them. And I love it when women like Erika Lust say, you know what, let's change the narrative. Let's make feminist porn. Let's reclaim our sexual pleasure. Let's make erotica that doesn't only cater to the straight male gaze. But that doesn't do away with the fact that the majority of porn does exactly that.
Yeah. It's one thing to say, like, I am differently valuing this for myself. Like, I am going to take this power structure and I, for my relationship, mm-hmm, and the way that I value it, I am going to upend that power structure. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't do anything for social power structures or patriarchy, mm-hmm, that affects other people. Mm-hmm. It just means that you are enlightened and you and your partner are enlightened about what you're doing, yeah, but it doesn't have any greater impact, yeah, on the social institutions of power, mm-hmm, that control how we interact with one another on a day-to-day,
yeah,
basis.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's again this like neoliberal idea of you do you, you know, you make yourself.
And I am for people doing, yes, themselves, but yes, it seems somewhat selfish too.
Not just selfish. It's also, it's kind of, you know, it's kind of a calming, soothing illusion of, you know, I'm such an empowered woman. I can do whatever I want. I, yes, can have sex the way I want, which is, yes, of course. Yes, fine. Do that.
But also. But all, like, do that. You be you and do your sex thing and
yes, more power to you.
Do it.
Yes.
But also.
But then there's also society around that.
Yeah. And so, like, do that. And as part of that, focus on the things that are close to you and, like, do that. But also think bigger.
Yeah.
Like, think about how you can make this a reality for other people.
Yeah.
And not just for yourself.
Yeah. And also understand that whatever you enjoy in your life and whatever you learn to like is also part of a structure. It's not,
yes,
you did not come out of nowhere. Yeah,
your ideas are not just your ideas. Exactly. They are totally influenced by everything that goes on around you. They're influenced by the television you watch. They're influenced by the friends that you have around you, your parents, social structures, organizations, churches, the media,
pornography,
all of
everything. Yeah. So I think the crux is you are not as free as you think you are.
No. No, we are not.
Yeah.
Well, and it goes back to that, the woman, the libertarian who said society, when it makes laws in the area of sexuality, the government discriminates against women. Like, yeah, I mean, we are not free. Like, women are also discriminated against in laws that are made for us. Like, but everything around us discriminates against women in one way or another. And not just women, but anybody who's in a disadvantaged position. Yeah, so it's not just laws that are being made. It's everything. Yeah. And this is probably not making you feel any more positive about society.
No, but you know,
that's not what we do.
That's not what we do. That's what I have chocolate for. So I think recognizing that you're not as free as you think you are, and that you are part of a power structure, and critiquing that does not necessarily mean that you're sex negative. Mm-hmm. I sometimes feel like a lot of people that call themselves sex positive feminists are very, as you said, naive to those power structures that govern our lives, govern our behaviors, yes, govern our desires too. And for me, like, I am a feminist and I am absolutely sex positive, but I'm also absolutely sexism negative. And being a feminist implies applying a critical feminist lens that analyzes structural inequalities, even to things that bring me pleasure.
Yeah. I think the idea of being sex positive and sexism negative is a really good way to approach it. Like, have sex or not, or whatever. Let other people have sex and do their deal. But question the sexism that is part of our everyday lives.
Yeah.
And everything that's around us.
Yeah.
Be okay with the sex itself, but question all of the stuff that surrounds it.
Yeah. And I think a part of that is also at some point understanding that in a patriarchal society, there's no way to ever be free of it. So there's no way you can ever have sex that is patriarchy free. You're laughing because it's making people feeling even worse.
I'm crying right now. This is so sad. But yeah, no, you're
but
right.
I think it's kind of
no,
this,
you're right.
This is something I bring to the table a lot of times when people discuss certain media, whatever, is that I say, well, we live in a patriarchal society. Whatever we're discussing right now, it cannot be perfect.
No.
There's no way.
There's no such thing as a sex positive utopia where we are free from patriarchal influences on our thoughts and actions. It just doesn't exist.
No.
And even if we tried to make it, it wouldn't be real because we come from this patriarchal society that will be influencing everything we do. And so even if we try to create something that's like super feminist and non-patriarchal, it will necessarily be influenced by patriarchy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there is no sex positive feminist utopia.
No.
That's not how we wanted to end things today per se, but that's how we're ending it.
But there's chocolate.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, there's small steps on the way.
Agreed.
There's, you know, critical thinking.
Yes.
And there's, at least to a certain extent, understanding your own participation in those things. And I think that's all we can get.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Well.
Great. So lessons learned.
Yeah. Again, have sex or don't have sex, or do whatever you want to do. Let others do what they want to do.
Fight the patriarchy.
Fight the power. And stay nasty.
Stay nasty. Bye.
Bye.